I first started reading his book, The Religious Function of the Psyche, a number of years ago when it came out. And I quickly realized that I had other colleagues who were reading the book. I'm an Episcopal priest. I have a number of friends who are spiritual directors in the Episcopal tradition and Roman Catholic tradition. And they're all reading Dr. Corbett's book to learn how to be better spiritual directors. We live in a time where religion has been hijacked by ideology, and we all know it. We live in a time where people also think if they go to a weekend and read one book, they're spiritual. They don't have to do anything, they're just spiritual. And it's very important in this kind of world where people are either using religion for bad purposes or running away from it or thinking it's easy, that we have a person of the depth of Dr. Corbett, an English person trained in Chicago, a Jungian analyst, a professor at Pacifica. He has a new book coming out, and I will let him tell you about that. We tried really hard to get it for tonight. We were unable to, but I think you're going to be fascinated to hear him. And we have one more introduction. I don't know Dr. Corbett, but Anya does. And we have convinced her that she should share a bit of what she knows
he
about.
He was a professor of mine at Pacifica. And when you have somebody who is as, you should cover your ears now. who is as careful, scholarly, erudite, precise in his thinking, and you feel very safe, but you also can feel, if it was somebody else, you might feel bored, but that is not at all the case with with Dr. Corbett. And it was not the case then. We felt that the terrain he was covering was exciting. He's exceedingly focused on it, and the two topics that he's going to talk about tonight and tomorrow are he's bringing together two things tonight, and I think maybe. And two things tomorrow that aren't usually brought together. And so it's an unconventional moves. He's making unconventional moves in this very careful way. So that thrills me, and I hope you are thrilled also.
Thank you.
I want to say something about the new book. The new book is just my attempt to explain what I really meant in the first book. I'm going to talk about an emerging spiritual practice that's arising from the tradition of depth psychology. It's arising in consulting rooms and in small groups like this all over the country. Are you hearing me at the back at all? Somewhat. It's useful for two groups of people. It's useful for people who have an interest in who are committed to a traditional religion, and it's useful also for people who have a personal sense of the sacred, but who are not related to, who can't really find a home in any of the established traditions. It's particularly important in that group, a group of people who have a powerful sense of the sacred individually, but find that they're somewhat turned off by the traditional religions. I won't bore you with all the reasons that people are disillusioned with the traditions, because I'm sure that everyone here is familiar with all that. One of the major reasons that we're disillusioned with the traditions is that the way the traditions have told us that the sacred manifests itself may not be the way we actually experience the sacred in practice. Some time ago, a friend of mine called me up and said that he'd had a dream in which a voice said to him, God dooms us to live a life apart from him. And he called me up and he said, how can that possibly be? He's been committed to the church for a long time. And he said, what could this dream possibly mean? And I was reminded of Meister Eckhart's comment when he said, God save me from God. Meaning that if you have a traditional preconceived idea of the way the sacred should manifest itself, then when you actually have an experience of the sacred, you may not realize what you're experiencing. It may not live up to your actual expectations. So the traditions that have told us the way in which the sacred is, as it were, supposed to appear, through the sacraments of the church or the commandments of the Torah or whichever tradition you happen to belong to. But in fact, what we're finding nowadays is that people experience the sacred in all kinds of ways, apart from those traditional ways. They experience the sacred in dreams, in visionary experience, in relationships, in creative work, in the natural world, in the body. The body is making something of a comeback. In synchronistic events and a variety of other ways. I'll try and cover several of them this evening. I may not cover all of them. So I want to talk tonight about the way the sacred actually manifests itself rather than the way they told you it should do in Sunday school. And I find that they're not the same thing. So I want to talk about first of all, some criteria. Well, if I'm going to make this claim that the sacred can manifest itself in ways outside the traditional ways that we've been told to expect it, how do we know that this is a manifestation of the sacred? What criteria do we use? And here I'm going to borrow from Jung, who borrowed from Otto. So this is my fantasy about Jung's fantasy about Otto's fantasy. So, you know. But this is what I think is happening here. In the 30s, I think about 1937, Jung gave the Terry Lectures on the Psychology of Religion at Yale. And he'd recently read the work of Otto. And the book is called The Idea of the Holy. In German, it's simply called Das Heilige. It was translated as The Idea of the Holy because I think that people thought he was a Kantian, so it had to be just the idea of the holy, not the holy itself, whatever that is. And what Otto was trying to do was get at the essence of religious experience. He felt that there'd been too much emphasis on formal worship services and those kind of spiritual practices, morality and so on, and the people had lost touch with the essence of religion, which had to do with personal experience of the sacred. So Otto tried to articulate the essence of sacred experience. And he used the term numinous to describe this. And what I'd like to do is give you an example of several types of numinous experience. He said that a numinous experience is mysterious, tremendous, and fascinating. Examples, obvious biblical examples, would be something like Moses at the burning bush. Moses is tending his father-in-law's sheep, and he sees the bush which is not consumed by the fire, and a voice speaks to him out of the bush and says, come over here, I have a job for you. Or Saul on the road to Damascus on his way to persecute Jesus' followers. Here's a voice saying, why do you persecute me? And sees a blinding light, had thrown off his horse, he's blind for 3 days. That's what Otto is talking about when he talked about numinous experiences. And obviously those experiences are mysterious, tremendous, fascinating, and so on. So those were the criteria that Otto used. And he said that it's an experience of otherness. It's an experience of something that's obviously not ordinary, that not from this realm. Something that seems to be way out of our ordinary everyday experience that we can't explain. It's a total mystery. It's completely fascinating. And it's awe-inspiring, A-W-E, awe. It produces a kind of dread, a kind of holy fear, not the kind of fear that you have if you've just had a narrow escape on the freeway, but more the kind of dread that when you it's more like something that's uncanny, like seeing a ghost. It's that kind of awe is what Otto was talking about. Sometimes you have one of these experiences and you feel blessed or cleansed in some way. Usually there are experiences that make us feel very humble, small, what Otto called the creature feeling. When you have one of these experiences, you realize that you're in relation to something much larger than yourself. So those are the two great biblical examples. But it turns out that these examples are not confined to just to the founders of the tradition, not just to Moses or Jesus or to Muhammad taking dictation from the angel Gabriel. I mean, these kinds of experiences, these kinds of numinous experiences, happen to ordinary people all the time. And they're very important because they can have a very healing effect. In fact, in about 1945, Jung wrote in a letter that he thought that the essence of what he thought the essence of his method of psychotherapy was contact with the numinous. He thought that was the real healing factor. That's, in a way, Jung's theory of cure, that you're really cured because of essence, because of connection with that essence, connection with the transcendent realm, with the transpersonal realm. Now, the Jungians think of this in terms of connection, of relationship to the transpersonal level of consciousness. And I don't know, most people in this group, I don't know whether people are familiar with Jung's notion of the objective psyche or the autonomous psyche. Can I just assume that everyone knows that and skip that? Thank God for that. Okay. Anyway, there's a dimension of consciousness beyond the personal, which Jung originally referred to as the collective unconscious. We now tend to talk about it as the objective psyche or the autonomous psyche. And most of us feel that when you have one of these experiences, it's essentially like the mind of God, or what in Zen would be called big mind, or something like that. Some transcendent level of consciousness beyond the personal. And when you have a numinous experience, somehow your own individual consciousness is in relation to that larger consciousness that normally we don't experience very often. So what I'd like to do is give you some examples of that. Maybe I should, in the interest of full disclosure, tell you how I became interested in this myself, because a big point that I'm going to make is that these experiences may not take a Judeo-Christian form. They may take a Judeo-Christian form. I mean, people still have visions of Jesus or the Virgin Mary on a somewhat regular basis, although, as I'll talk to you about, people are often reluctant to describe those kind of experiences, because they're afraid that if they say they've had a vision like that, the people will think that they're crazy. But very often the experience is quite novel, and it really doesn't fit into the traditional ways of thinking about the divine. So maybe I'll do is talk about some unusual sort of non-Judeo-Christian forms of numinous experience. Because when you have one of these experiences yourself, you have a private, a personal experience of the sacred. Now, the way I got interested in this was that many years ago, I was going through a period of turmoil in my life, and usually these experiences will occur during periods of turmoil. There doesn't seem to be a lot of need for an experience of the sacred when things are going well. So they're most helpful when one is in turmoil. Anyway, so I happened to look up through a window, looked up into the sky, and as I looked up in the sky, I saw a large face in the sky looking down at me. Now, that's a very numinous experience. It was very powerful. At the time, I was running an inpatient psychiatric unit, and I was hearing these stories all day, so it was also somewhat alarming to have the experience myself. And if we have time, later on I can talk about the difference between these kind of experiences and psychosis. They're really not the same, although there is some overlap, but we can get back to that. I didn't know quite what to make of this experience. It was quite brief. In fact, let me just tell you what William James, when he writes about this, he says that these characteristics have... There are four characteristics of these kind of experiences. This is William James. First of all, they're ineffable. It's very difficult to describe them in ordinary conceptual language. And unless you've had an experience like this, it's difficult to convey the quality of the experience. What Otto is really trying to do is convey a certain emotional quality that makes them different than ordinary experiences. Secondly, they have a noetic or cognitive aspect. They give you some information that you didn't know before. They produce a kind of sense of understanding or clarity. You get something that you didn't get before. And I'll give you some of these instances which are like teaching examples. And the experience, by the way, is what I call self-authenticating. In other words, if you have a burning bush or a road to Damascus kind of experience, you don't usually argue with it. And if people tell you it didn't happen, you know that it did happen. So that's what I mean by self. You don't need anyone to tell you that it's real, okay? Because the experience has a tremendous sense of authority about it. And then it's transient. Usually it's quite brief. Rarely lasts more than half an hour, although there are occasions where it can go on for a few days, but that's quite rare. James's fourth point is that during the experience, one feels very passive. One's own will is in abeyance. There's nothing you can do to make it come or go. Those are James's criteria. Anyway, I had this experience. I didn't know what to make of it. And then I had, a little while after that, a dream of a very large UFO. This was a dream, not a waking experience. And it was a huge thing, enormously large, and it started to descend, got closer and closer, and finally hovered a short distance above my head, which was numinous in its own right because it was so big. And then light shone down, rather like this, actually. And searchlights from the base of this thing. And when I looked up, the light was coming out of eyes. What would be normally the lens of the light or the bulb was actually eyes, and the base of this thing was studded with eyes, and the light was coming out of these eyes on me. So obviously the waking vision of the face looking at me and this dream experience of being looked at by these eyes had this common theme of being looked at from above. Now, a UFO is obviously not a Judeo-Christian manifestation of the sacred. But if Otto is correct, if Otto's criteria are worthwhile, and I should say that not everyone agrees with Otto. People have other ways of thinking about what the nature of authentic religious experiences, but that's an academic discussion. But if for a moment you'll accept Otto's criteria that it's an experience of the sacred, if it's mysterious, tremendous, and fascinating, and awe-inspiring, and dreadful, and so on, then this would qualify as a numinous experience. It obviously was an experience, both of them together, of something other. You probably know Jung's essay in volume 10 about on flying saucers, that he thought were experiences of the transpersonal self because they're mandala shaped. Can I skip over what all that's about and just assume that everyone knows what I'm talking about? So the imagery is of being seen by something from another realm. That's what Otto is talking about, being in touch or related to something from another realm, not from this earth, from somewhere else. And that's the experience of the numinous, that there's a transcendent dimension, and for a moment, somehow the veil is lifted and we're in touch with that. We have an experience of that. Now, I've heard a lot of these experiences in therapy, and I've brought a collection of them. And what I'm interested in is, what is the relationship of the way the numinous manifests itself and the individual psychology of the experiencer? Why did Moses experience it as in the form of fire, for example, and not in some other form? I mean, fire is a very ancient manifestation of the sacred in many traditions. The tongues of flame at Pentecost descending on the disciples of Jesus and so on. There are all kinds of ways in which the sacred manifests itself as fire. The Bible's full of it. But it appears in other ways as well. So why fire and why not some, like Job experienced it as a whirlwind, for example. So I'm interested, I would say to Moses, if he was here, what does fire mean to you? Why do you get it particularly in the form of fire? What is the relationship of the way it appears and one's character structure? So I thought to myself, well, why would I get it in the form of these of being seen in this way? And of course, the answer is a personal complex of mine, which has to do with growing up feeling not seen, and suffering from. I don't know if that's happened to anybody else, but I was greatly helped by a Vedic astrologer who said to me, "I know the problem. The problem is your soul doesn't come from around here." That was a big relief to me. But I did grow up with a like many people, with a sense of being an alien and not really belonging, and wondering what the heck I was doing here and why these strange people were doing what they... I still think that, actually, when I read the papers. But you may know that sense of not belonging and of not really being seen for who one is. Of course, it was a family problem. I remember after I'd been in practice about 20 years, going home to visit my parents and my mother saying to me, "Now, what is it you do?" So it's that kind of thing about not being seen. Okay. So this is obviously a complex that I'm obviously revealing itself now. And this